This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to school to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments. Today, Putnam manages money for more than 9 million individual and institutional investors worldwide. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
1 year ago today, the Dow closed at its record high, 14,164. The blue chips closed today almost 40% off that number. We've said before that the Dow is not the entire U.S. economy, but as a snapshot, boy, it's not a pretty picture. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by the American Public Transportation Association, committed to helping Americans save on gas and become energy independent at publictransportation.org. And by Gather.com, where friends keep up with the people, conversations, and moments that matter most. People are talking about the economy at Gather.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. It is Thursday, the 9th of October today. Good to have you with us once again as the fallout spreads and as we continue our coverage of the financial crisis in this economy. All right, now, repeat after me. This is not a stock story. This is not a stock story. This is not a stock story. Until it is. If people can't get credit, they can't buy things. One of the things they can't buy is cars. Why that matters and what the market said about it is where we'll start today. And Henry Paulson's excellent adventure continues. The Treasury Secretary and former CEO Goldman Sachs is going to go back into the banking business. Whether you're an investor or just an observer of American capitalism, General Motors is one of the grand old business names in this country. Its stock has been traded for what seems like forever. It's a Dow component, in fact. But after today's developments, there's real worry about what used to be the world's biggest car company. From Washington, Marketplace's Steve Henn has the story.
In 1929, just before the stock market crashed, General Motors was worth $4 billion. Today, at the close of trading in New York, GM was worth less, just $3.5 billion. General Motors shares fell more than 31% today alone, and they've lost roughly half their value this week. But the biggest blow came after Standard & Poor's warned it might downgrade GM's credit rating in the middle of a global credit freeze. The agency said GM has enough cash for the rest of this year, but 2009 could be a challenge. GM lost $15.5 billion in the second quarter of this year, and its U.S. sales are down 18% so far this year. For months, GM's management has been focused on strengthening its cash position to weather this storm. But if consumer demand for automobiles dries up further, surviving will become much more difficult. In Washington, I'm Steve Henn for Marketplace.
Henry Paulson probably gets driven around Washington in a Ford Crown Victoria. Shares in that company, by the way, hit $2 at one point today. But no matter what he drives, Paulson's about to steer a different path on the bailout package, one that would make taxpayers more, shall we say, active participants in the financial markets. Our Washington Bureau Chief John Dimsdale is here to walk us through that plan. Hello, John.
Hello, Kai.
So, do that walking thing. What is the idea here?
Well, this is a direct injection of taxpayer money into banks in return for stock. The government would identify troubled financial institutions and buy an equity stake. The money that the banks get, in theory at least, should persuade them that it's safe to lend and borrow and get credit markets unstuck.
What's the benefit, though, of this plan versus the original bailout idea, which is taking those bad assets off the bank's books, the bad loans?
Well, it should work faster. Banks could get access to this money right away, and the government can start doing it by the end of the month. So we wouldn't have to wait for the infrastructure that's needed to identify bad loans and negotiate the prices. That's going to take several weeks to get going.
What about risk to you and me, though, John, the taxpayer?
Well, it's a stock play. It's buying stock. Taxpayers are taking a bet that the banks are going to recover and grow, and eventually this stock can be sold with a gain to the Treasury.
It's scary to hear you talking about the government of the United States making a stock play.
Especially today.
That's right. If this is going to work faster and going to have, you know, some risk, maybe a little bit less, why didn't Henry Paulson do this first instead of making it Plan B?
Well, it's partly ideology. This is a partial nationalization of the banking industry, and the industry itself opposes it since it dilutes the value of stocks that are owned by existing shareholders. Taxpayers would get preferred shares, and that means they're first in line to get a share of the profits. I talked to one banker today who called the capital injections counterproductive. He said that once Treasury moves in and buys a stock in a bank, it'll scare away other private investors because they'll figure, hey, the government has looked at the books and they found weaknesses. It's like what happens when the neighbors see a doctor walk into a house down the street. They figure, hey, something's wrong.
Well, investors were plenty scared today, though, John, even though the capitalization idea has been out there since at least last night. It's been floating around a little bit longer than that. Why aren't traders reacting more positively?
Well, the interpretation of the opponents of the idea are saying, yeah, the markets don't like this. But others are saying, you know, the markets have concluded that there's not going to be any quick fix to this credit crisis. And more generally, stock investors are looking at a pervasive global economic downturn that's going to have long-lasting effects on jobs and consumer spending and therefore stock performance. So a fix for the credit markets is only one part of a much larger picture for the stock market. If taxpayers taking a stake in banks works, that's a first step, and it is a big step to recovery, but it's only one in working our way out of a very troubled and unbalanced economy overall.
Now the timetable question, John. How long do you think it will be before the White House or Treasury Secretary Paulson officially announce it today? The White House danced around it a little bit at a press conference.
It sounds like it'll come pretty soon, maybe in conjunction with the upcoming G7 finance ministers meeting tomorrow.
And then the IMF, of course, this weekend. John Dimsdale in Washington, where all of that stuff is going to happen. Thank you, John.
You're welcome, Kai.
When I said this isn't a stock story up at the top a minute ago, what I meant was it's really a credit story, one that the Fed had hoped to at least partially solve yesterday with that big rate cut. It cut what's known as the federal funds target rate, the rate the Fed hopes banks will use to lend to one another. The idea is that banks will then pass on that cheaper money to companies and eventually individual borrowers. But it really hasn't worked out that way so far. The rates at which banks lend to each other did drop slightly overnight, but they are still at record highs. From New York, Ashley Montite reports.
The Fed made a big deal of cutting rates, but the banks ignored it. The way they see it, their peers are too risky to lend money to at such a low rate of interest. Hugh Johnson is chief economist at Johnson Illington Advisors. He says the banks simply don't trust each other.
One of the reasons they don't have a high level of confidence is because everybody's sort of wondering, what are the potential losses that other financial institutions, be they investment banks or commercial banks or a combination of the two, what is the level of liabilities that they really face?
That fear of the unknown has translated into sky-high rates of interest, both for the banks and for regular borrowers. Nigel Galt is chief U.S. economist with Global Insight. He says in this climate, the Fed could slash its target rate to zero and it still wouldn't thaw the credit markets.
It may be that we'll have to go there eventually, or we will go close to zero. But on its own, it's not going to do the job. You just have to look at the experience of Japan in the 1990s.
Back then, he says, interest rates plummeted. The Japanese government pumped money into the banks, but the banks still refused to lend. Sound familiar? This time round, the U.S. government appears to be moving beyond rate cuts. It's talking about taking stakes in financial institutions. Galt says that could help restore confidence. Hugh Johnson says the idea will take some getting used to.
We'd kind of like to keep the federal government out of the private sector.
He says buying bits of banks may be un-American, but at this point, it's probably necessary. In New York, I'm Ashley Milne-Tite for Marketplace.
It's tough to predict the next big thing in a story that's moving as fast as this one is, but Friday's looking good. That's when the Lehman Brothers' outstanding credit default swaps are going to be settled to the tune of $400 billion. Remember, those are basically insurance that companies buy from one another without any regulation whatsoever. Perhaps not surprisingly, given the turn of events the past month, the Fed wants to impose some order on the credit default market, which is why there's a big meeting tomorrow to try to hammer out some rules. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genza reports.
Credit default swaps are like bets. I want insurance in case a company fails, so I buy a swap. I'm betting it will fail. The person on the other end of the deal thinks the company will be just fine. If it is, they keep my money. If not, they're supposed to pay up. Decision Economics senior economist Pierre Ellis says it's kind of like betting on a game with a buddy.
You want to be sure that should that person lose, they will have the resources to pay off the bet. And that's what a clearinghouse does.
The clearinghouse would be a referee. Ellis says it would standardize swap contracts and make sure the parties have enough cash to pay up. And the rules would still apply if the swaps were traded. Say the company I bet against looks like it will go under and I'll win. If I need cash right away, I can sell my swap to someone else. Right now, the swap trading is unregulated, so everybody's gotten tangled up. It's like a big, sticky spider's web. Wayne State University law professor Peter Henning says Lehman Brothers was caught up in the web, then it failed.
Of course, when one part of the web came unhinged, it affected everything else.
Milken Institute economist Jim Barth says a clearinghouse would bring all the swap traders under one roof. They could see the entire web and minimize the damage.
All the other parties are there that will fully understand that something has happened and be able to collectively deal with that particular problem.
But do we really want to encourage credit default swaps? Barth says they're just a tool. If used properly, they won't cause chaos. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
Speaking of chaos and the stock markets, well, it's just going to be less painful if you wait till we get there. Details, as always, when we do the numbers. It's easy to get bogged down in the nitty-gritty of the credit crunch if you're not careful. But, of course, there's lots more going on out there than Henry Paulson investing in banks or those banks not really buying into the rate cut. The currency markets have been hopping. As we've said, the dollar has been on a tear against the euro. The Japanese yen is outdoing them both. But if you're wondering how bad our financial condition could get, Japan is a good place to look. The recession that started there back in the early 1990s is called the Lost Decade, although by many accounts that recession is now well into its second decade. Marketplace's Scott Tong went to Tokyo for us to see if there are any lessons for the United States today.
At first blush, economic stagnation is hard to see in Tokyo. Store owners with bullhorns hawk mobile phones and laptops. And folks in suits buy them. And skyscrapers here stand taller and shinier than ever. But this is normal Japan compared to the outrageous 1980s. Jeff Kingston teaches at Temple University in Tokyo. He wrote a book about the bubble days.
There are reports about people eating Japanese noodles and soup, which they would sprinkle gold flakes into. At ritzy establishments, they would serve sushi on top of a naked woman.
Japanese investors blew economic bubbles chewing the same gum Americans did. Low interest rates propped up unsafe loans, which propped up unrealistic housing prices. When the Japanese crash came, Kingston says the politicians did nothing but sit, 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 sit.
There is a Japanese proverb, if it stinks, put a lid on it. That pretty much fits the banking sector of Japan in the 1990s. The bad loans stank a real lot, and they had to put a lid on it.
The government waited 7 years before bailing out the banks. And by then, it was too late. The disease had spread. Things are still bleak today. Investors spend less, businesses hire less, and for many, lifelong employment is no more. So many Japanese shop at places like this, a discount store selling bargain TVs, and more pawn shops and 100 yen stores, the dollar stores here, pop up all over town. On the edge of Tokyo lies the blue-collar suburb of Ota. The economic pain here is obvious. This place once hummed with family workshops. Now every other one stands shuttered. Mairoko Denki still operates a small electronic parts business, but his customer base is shrinking every year.
I used to have dreams. I played golf and spent money on my car. Now I can't afford those. The only thing I do for my mental health is take a vacation to the hot springs every year and recharge.
One word keeps popping up here. Bubble. Namayo Kotani runs a five and dime store, where a year's worth of black dust covers many items on the shelf.
Since the bubble burst, about half the small and medium companies have gone under. So fewer people work here, which hurts my business.
Those who still work take the train into Tokyo every day. But social critic Masaru Tamamoto says they walk more slowly now. In the 1980s, they walk with purpose.
The assumption was tomorrow is going to be a better day. The Japanese economy will forever grow. After the bubble burst, then that whole thing blew up.
So will Americans experience their own lost decade? Jeff Kingston at Temple University says a key lesson from Japan is when the government sits on its hands, the crisis deepens. He credits Washington for quick action, the congressional bailout, and the Fed interest rate cuts. Still, they may have a long way to go.
If Japan has any basis to judge the current crisis in the United States, it's clear there's going to be a lot more bad news coming out. So I think Americans need to brace themselves for that.
This from someone who's seen this movie before and hoping for an alternative ending. In Tokyo, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
Coming up, echoes of the past that sound familiar.
The 1920s were a period of speculative excess, of unregulated exuberance and mayhem, leading to an enormous collapse of confidence.
But first, let's do the numbers. Markets cascaded down today on a lack of confidence and credit. You decide which one there was less of. The Dow Industrials carved off 678 points, most of that in the final hour or so. 7.3% on the blue chips, closed at 85.79, below 9,000 for the first time in five-plus years. The NASDAQ fell 95 points, 5.5%, to end at 1645. The S&P 500 tanked 75 points, 7.6%. Finished at 9.09. Financial stocks, as you might imagine, took a beating. Morgan Stanley unloaded more than 25%. Goldman Sachs, really not so golden, falling more than 10%. J.P. Morgan Chase chased away 6.67%. The 10-year T-note kept on dropping the price, that is. The yield rose to 3.77%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Vanguard, offering investments designed to help individuals, institutions, and advisors reach their long-term financial goals. 888 Vanguard. And by Constellation Energy, working to provide responsible, sustainable energy to power America's future. Constellation Energy, the way energy works. The Marketplace Entrepreneurship Desk is supported by the Kauffman Foundation, online at kauffman.org. Want to know what our hosts and reporters are experiencing as they cover America's financial crisis? You'll find their stories, insights, and observations at our website. Head to marketplace.org and look for the staff blog.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a glance at events coming up Friday. The Commerce Department releases the trade balance report for August. The G7 finance ministers meet at the Treasury. Treasury Secretary Henry Paulson will hold a press conference following the talks. And today, Fiji celebrates its 28-year independence from British colonial rule with parades, poetry, and marching bands. I'm Caitlin Carroll.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal.
The thing about a market story like the one we're in, whether it's the credit markets we're talking about or the stock markets, is that it's pretty easy to tell how all the various fixes are working. The short answer, of course, is so far not so well. We told you about tight short-term credit up at the top of the program and how not much has really changed since the big global rate cut yesterday. Equity investors voted with their feet again today. So we have called Andrew Lowe at MIT's School of Management, the Sloan School there, to find out what investors are thinking.
Well, you know, part of the problem is that investors aren't thinking right now. They're reacting, and they're reacting emotionally, mainly with fear. And unfortunately, although there's never a good time for a crisis, this crisis hit at just about the worst possible time in the sense that we're in between administrations. So we don't even know which team is going to be leading the effort to rescue the economy in January. And fear of the unknown is probably the strongest kind of fear there is. And that's exactly what's going on throughout the world right now.
But the government's trying so hard. It's pumping cash in. It's cutting rates. The Treasury Secretary has these new powers. I mean, what's unknown about what the government's trying to do?
Well, you know, there is still a lot, though, that is unknown. For example, this rescue package and the number that's been bandied about, $700 billion. That's a very scary amount of money that we're talking about. And I think that a number of Americans don't really understand exactly where that money's going to go and actually where it's going to come from. You know, if we look at the numbers from a bigger perspective, $700 billion is actually quite manageable because at the end of 2007, U.S. household net worth was about $53 trillion. So we're talking about maybe 1.5% at most of our household net worth. But nevertheless, the numbers sound scary. I think that the government's actions are quite laudable, but we really need to have some kind of leadership to understand exactly what's going on.
You know, there's a school of thought that goes, look, we've got an expert on the Great Depression, Ben Bernanke, running the Fed. We've got a guy who knows Wall Street running the Treasury Department. What's the disconnect? I mean, is that not translating to the everyday investor?
Well, there's no doubt that these two individuals are extraordinarily well qualified for dealing with the situation that we're in. So I think you'd be hard-pressed to find two individuals that you'd rather have in those roles. But they don't necessarily inspire the kind of public confidence that I think we're looking for. We really need to have a spokesperson that can inspire that kind of confidence. You know, going back to people like Ronald Reagan or Bill Clinton or Warren Buffett, for that matter. That's the kind of leadership that I think the public is looking for at this point.
Let me get you to the news of the day that Secretary Paulson is considering a direct equity investment in some of these banks. Has his strategy changed course from buying up bad assets to buying stock in banks because investors and the markets are so uneasy?
Well, that may be part of it, but I think another part may be that in looking over the various different opportunities, he's been able to identify some significant opportunities for taxpayers. There's a very big difference between taking an equity position in a company that's troubled, but that could pull out of it, and then the equity could be quite valuable versus simply buying up the bad assets. You know, a short-term fix is to buy these troubled assets and just take them off the books of these companies, but that's not a long-term fix. A long-term fix may well be to take a piece of the equity and help the company get back on its feet.
Doesn't exactly inspire confidence in a market looking for confidence, though, when the guy in charge sort of does a 180 on his strategy.
Well, that's exactly right. I think that's one of the reasons you see these markets being as choppy as they are, and this is the kind of leadership that I was referring to. We do need to have somebody at the top that can express a degree of confidence and even optimism that we are going to get out of this and that we will have the wherewithal to be able to deal with all of these issues.
Andrew Lowe is a professor of finance at the Sloan School of Management at MIT. Professor Lowe, thanks a lot for your time.
My pleasure. Thank you.
I'll be the first to admit that this hasn't been the most feel-good program lately. It's hard to be upbeat when we have to play the sad music all the time. Reporting the economic news, and yeah, I know, listening to it too during times like these can be downright depressing. But as you look around, there are plenty of pundits and politicians and journalists talking about the depression. So we asked Nate DeMayo to figure out whether all that talk makes any sense.
What do we talk about when we talk about the depression? During the Great Depression, a man, a good, hard-working, salt-of-the-earth American, we'll call him Tom. Well, once Tom built a railroad, made it run. Then he got a Wall Street job until the stock market crashed. Then he jumped out a window. But then a dust storm whooshed him off to Oklahoma, where he wandered around the country with newspapers in his shoes, selling apples while trying to bum dimes off hobos. Of course, history never quite matches up with the popular memory.
in 1929, we had a perfectly ordinary recession marked with a stock market crash. The market had been in a bubble for a while.
That's economic historian John Steele Gordon sounding pretty chill about a year in an event that most of us think of as earth-shaking cataclysm. He says people tend to bundle the crash and the Great Depression of the 1930s together as one giant event. But he says the crash year of 1929 is totally different from the height of the Depression a few years later.
This country is nowhere near the condition it was in 1932-33, which was about as close as a major industrial power can come to a complete breakdown in its economic system.
He's talking about bread lines and bank closures, 9,000 banks in all. Unemployment spiking past 25%. We're at 6% now. So from Gordon's historian's perspective, people should can it with the Depression talk.
It makes me somewhat angry at journalists, frankly, because, you know, they're in the business of selling newspapers, and Armageddon, I suppose, sells a lot of newspapers.
But just because we aren't facing Armageddon doesn't mean we can't learn from history.
The 1920s were a period of speculative excess, of unregulated exuberance and mayhem, leading to an enormous collapse of confidence.
That's liberal economist James Galbraith. He says if the root causes of the economic crisis of 1929 seem eerily similar to today, the response hasn't been. And that's a good thing. John Steele Gordon says that after the crash, the government did just about everything wrong. Instead of flooding the markets with cash, like the Fed does now, the government tightened up the money supply. It raised taxes. It started a trade war.
The result was the economy, already in serious decline, fell off a cliff.
Here's the difference.
Historian Jack Beatty of the Atlantic Monthly says we've learned from those mistakes.
Our political culture has the New Deal in it. Hoover's didn't.
FDR's New Deal, of course, went a long way to dig the country out of the Depression. It established market protections and regulations. It invested directly in the productive capacity of Americans, pumping money into big public works projects and all that. And that New Deal experience has allowed us to skip ahead to some New Deal-inspired solutions. You can think of what the government's done so far as 1933 reactions to 1929 problems.
The mode of intervention taken for the financial crisis,
the Henry Paulson solution,
was in some ways strikingly similar. The banking bill that Roosevelt passed, it extended government assistance to private bankers. It was a bank bill that bankers could have written.
John Steele Gordon says that even as we move to avoid 30-style catastrophe, there may still be extremely tough times ahead, but they simply can't be as tough on Americans as they were back then. I mean, thanks to the Depression, we have Social Security and depositors insurance. We have programs that mean so many more people have homes and investments that will hold at least some of their value through the crisis.
Since 1932, the first fiscal priority of the United States government has been to avoid another Great Depression.
It's not the 30s. It's a new era in a vastly different economy. And historians and economists say that although it's going to take much more than a spare dime to make things better, we can stop bringing up the Great Depression all the time. I'm Nate DeMeo for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by the American Public Transportation Association, helping America go green. You can calculate your carbon savings at publictransportation.org. And by Putnam Investments, managing a wide range of tax-exempt portfolios. Details at putnam.com. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note today, the financial crisis, as we've been telling you, knows no bounds. The situation in Iceland is only getting worse. The government took over that country's biggest bank today. The stock market was closed today. It's not going to open again until early next week. So we thought it might be helpful to be able to describe what's happening there. Landsfjárskreppa is how you say credit crunch in Icelandic. We called the embassy to find out. Oh, and in case you want to see what's going on there in person, Iceland Air, Boston to Reykjavik, starting from $600. Of course, that's one way. And that is Marketplace from American Public Media, which I have no idea, by the way, how to say in Icelandic. Today, the Dow hammered off 678 points, 7.3%. The NASDAQ slid 95 points, 5.5%. The S&P 500 tumbled 75 points, 7.6% there. Stephen Gregory, John Haas, Patty Hirsch, Betsy Streisand, and Lisa Tucker are the Marketplace editing staff. The managing editor is George Judson. Join us tomorrow for the Marketplace Morning Report and more coverage of the financial crisis. And I'll be in St. Louis tomorrow to finish our series, Road to Ruin. We'll find out how Missourians are dealing with all the uncertainty in the markets.
I can't do anything, so why worry about it? I mean, worrying about my money
ain't going to do me anything. It might give me an ulcer, then I have to pay a doctor.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.